And he had his glasses on upside
He had his
down.
glasses upside down.
And he was a legend.
Okay, joining me all the way from Japan is JC. JC, how are you, man?
What is up, Matty B?
So for anyone listening, this is Jess Ripper, and he lives in Japan, but we used to live together. We went to school together. How long have you been in Japan?
20 years the other day, a couple of days ago, yeah. 20 years now.
Crazy. Mm. Absolutely crazy. And I haven't seen you in, I don't know, 15 years?
When were you up here? You came up that time. I'm trying to remember the year. I can't
2005, I reckon it was. So Jazz and I were living in Japan 2004, 2006. So it would have had to have been our second year there. So 2005. Beautiful.
And that was the last time, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the last time. It's the only time Justine's met you. And like any time we get together, it was a killer time.
Yeah.
Yep, some longboarding. Some like very late night karaoke from memory.
I have no memory.
I've got some pretty good photos, like I said, of us.
Yumi was just saying how she remembers going to ramen with you guys.
Yeah, that's right. Because like everything in Japan, when we told people we were going to Asakawa, everyone was like, oh, yeah, got to try the ramen. I'm like, okay. So, like, I don't know why. You notice that. I'm sure living there 20 years. Like every little pocket of Japan has, like, oh, if you go there, you have to eat the ramen, or you have to eat the sashimi, or you have to eat the okonomiyaki when you go further south.
It's all the same to me, really.
I know. That's the thing. We ate it. Everyone was like, oh, how was it? We're like, just pretty much ramen.
Go to this town because the ice cream's so good.
Yeah, that's right. You're like, okay.
It's like ice cream.
Yeah. There's a place here, I think it's Hakone, where there's like black eggs, where they cook eggs in the sulfur. And they're like, oh, it's great. And then you eat them and you're like, it's a boiled egg. Cool.
Eggs.
Look at that. So 20 years in Japan. I remember the phrase I always used to say when we were there was like, living in Japan, like the first 10 years are the hardest. Is that right?
I don't know. It's gone by. It's gone, well, like everybody, I guess. It's gone by in a flash.
Yeah.
I was saying the other day, like the last 20 years living here, has certainly gone by way quicker than the first 22 years of life.
Yeah, that's a brutal thing to drop on people, but yes, you're 100% right.
Yeah, and I spent those first 6.5 years or so living up north in Asahikawa, where you can.
Yep.
And then I moved down in just 2007. I moved down to where I live now in the ski resort called Niseko, which is pretty famous, I guess. But I just remember that still have this feeling when I moved from Asahikawa down to here, I felt like I'd been in Hokkaido for so long.
Yeah.
And I'd done all sorts of crazy things like run bars and stuff. And it'd only been like 6 years, 6.5 years. And now living where we are, been here, I guess, for 13 years. And yeah, it's just weird how the whole time perspective thing.
Yeah. The older you get, the more it slips around, right?
Yeah, it flies.
So in that 20 years, so when you moved to Japan, so we just finished uni, obviously. We graduated at the same time. We went to Newcastle Uni. We both did education. And then, like, I don't even know if I've ever talked to you about, like, so when did you get the urge to go to Japan?
At some point towards the very end of uni. Actually, I do remember. I don't remember exactly, but I remember something happened. We were out. I mean, you're coming to the end of uni and you're doing, because we were doing teaching, so, you know, doing our internships and things like that.
Yeah.
And that was kind of cool and fun, but I remember we were out one night in Newcastle at one of the pubs. And I think...
Could you narrow it down?
It could have been the Great Northern. Actually, yeah. I think it was the Great Northern.
Right.
That's still around. And do you remember Justin Sinodinos?
Yeah.
Muzza.
Yeah, Muzza, yes, I got it.
I totally remember, well, in a boozy haze. I remember running into him, and it was definitely, and he, some reason out of nowhere, he's like, yeah, I'm going to Japan. I'm going to teach English.
Right.
And we kind of, I don't know, we just went on and on about it, but that was it. He told me that, and he told me the name of the company he was working for, and I somehow managed to remember it.
Was that Nova? Did you go up through Nova? Yeah. Yeah.
Nova. Yeah. Yeah.
Nova Usagi.
Novacation.
That's right. Oh, geez. That is a class. Forgot Novacation.
I think they went bankrupt or something.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of dodgy shit went on just after we left.
And that was it. And I don't know. That was, I guess I just went home after that and started. This is like early days internet as well.
Yeah.
I remember I was trying to find information and I don't know, somehow came across a website and found them and just went through the process of, and I was really into skiing at the time.
Right.
You probably remember like my bedroom wall, it was just covered.
Yeah, it was all like Whistler and Banff and all these places.
Ski resort trails, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I got talking to my stepfather who worked, remember Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he worked for Qantas. For
yeah, he was a pilot, wasn't he?
Oh, he's a flight attendant.
Oh, flight attendant, right.
Sort of back in the, I don't know, 70s, 80s, 90s. And yeah. And I remember he just like, oh, he was sort of on like, if you love skiing so much, you know, we used to fly to Sapporo. There's a shitload of snow in Sapporo.
Yeah.
Go there. And I don't know, I started looking up and realized, wow, you can ski in Japan, and just kind of started following those ideas. And one thing led to another, and I applied for a job, and I went for an interview in Sydney, and I got it. And
did you apply to go to Sapporo? Did you actually put in for
it? No, I think they gave me the choice, and I think I might have said Sapporo because that was like the only place I knew in Hokkaido. Right.
Yeah.
So this. Oh, so I got to go there. And then I remember I got the job, and I was like, "Well, I'm going to Japan," but it was still probably a week. It was pretty soon before I left, and I still didn't know where they were going to send me.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, like a week or two before I went, they called and said, oh, you're going to Asahikawa to work.
Right.
And I was like, what? Like, never heard of that place. And I looked on a map and I was like, wow. Like,
it's pretty much the like central point, isn't it, of like Hokkaido?
Right in the middle.
Right in the middle.
And it's an amazing place. It's sort of right next to it's actually the largest national park in Japan.
Yeah.
And it's just this huge volcanic mountain range.
Yeah, the photos I've got, like, just from a day where we were like, we're going to climb this mountain, and then we went up there and it was too windy, cable car was shut down, and so you were just like, we'll just we'll go for a walk, some of these trails, and just the autumn colours were out, and it was just stunning, just unbelievable. And
it's mind-blowing.
Yeah. And you were like, oh, you should come here in winter where you just ski all the time, but holy crap, that was a beautiful place.
It's pretty cool. I mean, four seasons, you know, summer's gorgeous. Winter's just incredible, but spring and autumn, it's I don't know. And so, they plonked me down in a sidecar, and I remember I left Australia in, it was February 20th.
Yeah.
So middle of summer, and which is middle of winter up here, and it gets cold up in central Hokkaido, and I think we landed, it was like minus 18 or something, and I'm just in like this short sleeve shirt with a leather jacket. And I was like, whoa.
And you wouldn't have known, you didn't know anybody.
No.
So that's what I was going to ask you is like, so you get there, you talk to your stepdad, Paul, and you have this idea to go there, but the actual leaving and going there to work in a job where you know absolutely no one, did you get homesick? Was it hard the first bit?
No, I never got homesick.
Right.
I don't remember ever getting homesick, you know. Just kind of dove in, and I don't know, it was just an adventure, and all I wanted to do was ski. And I mean, for skiing, I remember when they told me I was going to Asahikawa, I was a bit bummed out because the only place I knew was Sapporo,
right.
And I looked on a map and I was like, oh, it's about 250 kilometers. What? Like, that's not where I want to be. I want to be in Sapporo, you know? Like,
yeah.
And then I mean, if you're a skier or a snowboarder, I mean, living in central Hokkaido is absolute paradise.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And just got up there and couldn't really believe, you know, it's just a fantasy land. And
the snow season is what months up in Asahikawa.
I mean, right now I look outside my window and we've had a huge snow year this year.
Yeah.
It's been relentless. But I mean, it's usually starts snowing sometime in November. And I mean, you can ski all the way through until, April, May.
Yeah, I remember, I don't know if it was when we were over there, but I remember you sending me a picture of like, this is what I did this morning, and it was like snowboarding, like start of May or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long winter. It's too long, actually, these days. I'm kind of, it's still fun, but it's physical living too, just because the amount of snow that comes down. It's, it's not just like, I mean, you're out there with a shovel,
right?
Just laboring to keep your house from getting buried.
Right, so, geez. Yeah, that's something you never really encountered living on the coast in New South Wales.
No, yeah. So.
So you went from there. You're working for Nova, and then I don't know if there was a few steps in between it, but then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm running a bar. I'm running, was it Chico's? Is that the name of it?
No, that was the last bar. We did a few, actually.
Right.
And, I was working at Nova, and it was, I remember I was really sort of coming out of uni, so I was, kind of into the whole teaching aspect and teaching a bit of English, and then I kind of realized pretty quickly that it's not actually teaching.
Yeah, just, Nova is not teaching.
No, it was like open a textbook and read what it says and repeat.
Yeah, every day, repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat.
Pretty monotonous. And,
yeah.
And it's a business, so it was all about just making sure that the students were happy and they would sign up for another lesson sort of thing. And
yeah,
it wasn't really about. So I got pretty jaded, I remember, by that pretty quickly. And I think I only lasted about 4 months, I was just over it.
Wow. I think like when I remember being there, once when you get there and it's all like exciting and you're like, cool, I'm in Japan and doing all this. After about 4 months, you start to actually talk to people. And that's when I think they told us like the average male stays at Nova for like 12 months and the average female is like 9 months, just a super high turnover because it's boring and you get burnt out.
I mean, it's a means to an end. And the other side is like the life as a, I guess, a foreigner living in Japan, when you first get here, it's all pretty exciting and the whole culture. And I mean, you remember, right? You lived over here. Going out drinking and eating and
the drinking.
You can get away with too. Like, you can be a right, idiot.
Yeah. And it was always interesting, especially we'd been there like a year. We're still teaching at Nova, and the new teachers would turn up, and you could pick them immediately. Like you'd go out for your nomi hoidai and your karaoke nights, and you'd be like, "All right, that's a new person. All right, they're realizing what they can get away with."
So it's a pretty easy sort of. I mean, it's a cool thing to do actually for young people. I think if they want to travel a bit and see the world, it's a great thing to come out. But I was only, coming out for a year really, and I was going to just hopefully keep traveling. And
that's so funny. You came out for a year.
Yeah. And
still there.
Would have traveled a bit and gone back to Australia and done what I trained for, like found a job being a teacher.
Yeah.
That was always sort of the general life plan, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. I just fell into all sorts of different things. And I was at Nova, and then I was pretty over it, and I sort of met a few people, and this guy was running a bar, this English guy, and he was kind of not really into it, and it was a bar we used to go drinking at, kind of like the local foreigner bar or whatever you want to call it. Just not really, kind of like a Western, a pub, I guess, the closest thing to a pub.
Yeah, well, we had, where we were, there was a place called The Hub, which is a chain. I don't know if they had it in like any of the bigger cities in Hokkaido, but it's just a chain bar. It's like set up like an English pub, but it was really the only place that was set up like a bar near us. And we went there all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's comfort. It's kind of because it's the comfort a little bit like home, I guess. So.
Yeah.
And the guy that was running this place, and he was like, I don't know, he just put it out there that he was, I think he said he was going to close it down or something because he just didn't want to do it anymore. somehow he said, well, if you want to take it on, I'll introduce you to the, so it had this chap, it was owned by this bikey gang.
Okay.
Yeah, these badass guys that rode around on Harleys and, you know, black leather. They were, I think they were like a registered branch of the Hells Angels or something.
Remember when I suggested doing this podcast and you were like, oh, I don't know if I've got any interesting stories to tell?
I don't.
So now there's like, you're taking over a bar that's run by Japanese bikies. Okay, yep.
Cool. The nicest bikies you've ever met, though.
Right, yeah, of course. It's Japan.
They just look tough as.
Yeah.
And they own, so the boss guy, he owned the space. Yeah. And he saw it as a you know, money maker, so, but he wanted that, you know, that foreign sort of face running the place or whatever. And I don't know, one thing led to another, and next thing you know, I kind of quit Nova and the teaching gig and said, well, I'm just gonna do this for a bit. And so I took on the bar and just sort of ran the whole thing, and as long as he got his cut of the profits,
right?
It was crazy. I remember back then just thinking, like, because I was that was even before I was 23.
Jesus.
I might have just turned, I was just about to turn 23 or something.
Right.
So it was back then. And it was just, it was nuts. It was like, you've got this bar and it was busy. Like it was always just pumping.
Yeah.
And it got pretty crazy. And it was like, it was a 23 year old just
in charge.
Straight out of, like, straight in, you've only been in this country for a few months, and
Jesus.
It's like absolute freedom to like just be debaucherous and and not really speaking, like, couldn't speak any Japanese either. It was just, I don't know how it worked, but it went pretty well.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was definitely unhealthy.
So yeah, so I gotta ask, like, before I go any further, like, we lived together for, what is it, 3-4 years in Newcastle. Yeah. And again, when you're talking about time and how, like, the last 20 years seems to have gone by, that 3 years, we packed a lot in to that three years when I think about it. There's not like, oh, remember that one moment or remember that one night. It just seemed to be, as you said, with the bar, like, just pumping a lot.
Yeah.
At our place. It was like a center. It was like a social hub, I reckon, for most of our friends. Yeah. Somehow, I don't know why it was. I don't know if it was the design of, like, the house or if it was just the fact that we had, like, 8 couches all around and a really big deck in the backyard.
Yeah, it was pretty wild there.
Yeah, and the fact maybe that we were walking distance to about 9 or 10 drinking establishments probably helped.
Yeah.
But what is it about, like, you went to Japan just because you ran into someone who mentioned it. You started running a bar because someone was like, oh, do you want to do it? Is there something in you that's just like wants a new adventure?
Maybe. It was just, I just found it. It was just a really easy, fun existence.
Yeah.
You know, like, for that age, I mean, you're not, I guess some people are, but at that point in time, I wasn't thinking about the future. I wasn't thinking about anything. I did want to travel, and that's why I sort of came to Japan, but I was planning to keep moving.
I mean, that's a good description of you, JC, is just wanting to keep moving. There was always something happening when we lived together. There was always something happening. There was always energy. There was always like, well, all right, what are we doing? What's happening now? Let's do it. And just, I mean, how many nights started with you or me or Wigo or Flano, these people that we live with, just like, oh, let's go down the pub for a beer. And we're like, okay. Oh, I'll just call my friend. Let's call them. And then people just, all of a sudden, it's 6 o'clock in the morning and we're having a swim and we're like, sweet. Like, how did that happen? Let's do it again.
That's what you do, isn't it?
Like, yeah. Well, no, that's not what you do. That's not what, I mean, it is. Again, like, for some people, they might have like a couple of stories like that from when they were at uni, but that was like a weekly occurrence of just, oh, it started off quiet and, you know, we went to 8 different houses on that night or something. Like, we all ended up back at our house. It's just the way it went.
Yeah, I don't know. Choose your own adventure, I guess.
Nice. Yes.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, I kind of got up here and actually just clicked with a crew of like really good people, you know, Japanese and foreigners. And
yeah.
It was just snowboarding every day, you know, and in summer, like skateboarding every day and just working at night at the bar. And I mean, what else do you want to do? It's just,
yeah, that age, that's a pretty good lifestyle at 23.
No, it's not. You're not working, you're not chained down to a desk or, yeah. So it was just an adventure, and it was just a really cool, it's a beautiful part of the world, and the people were great. And, just about having fun at that
point. Yeah. And this crew of yours, was this known as the booze crew? Was that the original booze crew?
Yeah. Some of them. Yeah, no, for sure. That's like for sure the early days. But the booze crew took a few years to sort of come to fruition. That was probably more like 2005, 2006.
Right. I met quite a few of the booze crew when came up. I think, yeah, there were a few of them in the booze crew. They were snowboarders. They did a lot of filming. Did that continue for much longer, or was that
that was classic when we just kept, and that was just all about, again, it was just the continuation of just, I guess, like living hard, like going hard, like day and night, just drinking and partying, and then being up the next morning and just riding hard. And I don't know, started filming a lot of it with one of those little handheld video cameras.
Yeah.
And then one of the guys, probably my best friend, Dale, who I think you probably met Dale.
Yeah, I met Dale.
He just started editing all sorts of clips together and ended up putting out like three different movies, three DVDs. That was pretty funny.
I've got one.
It's so raw.
I've got one still.
Do you have one?
Yeah. Nice. I believe I invested in...
They were classic.
I think I sent you like $50 or something, like, to be like, hey, man, put this towards your booze crew. Because I met them. They were just like you said, they were just all about fun. They were all about just going for it. And I think more importantly, I think what it was like you were living... And we're going to get to it in a bit more detail, but you were living the dream that we had so many nights just sitting, watching TV, watching like skate videos and surfing videos and skiing videos, right? And snowboarding videos that you had. A lot of like 90s pop punk and a lot of like drinking and a lot of people doing crazy shit on their boards.
I don't know. I think that was part of it, like growing up on the coast.
Yeah.
You know, just jumping out of trees and surfing, riding waves and skate. I don't know, just doing stuff that, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. It's just fun. All this is fun. So everyone has different levels, I guess. But
yeah, but like I said, we used to watch these like videos that other people had made. And then I would just recognize, I didn't recognize myself because I didn't surf. I didn't jump out of trees. I didn't skateboard, but I was just like, oh, this is JC right here. This is JC. This is what he should be doing. And then we had friends who filmed every now and then, like Drez style, filming down at Avoca or whatever.
Yeah.
At the Wedge. I remember a few videos of the Wedge.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were, that's what it was like. It was like, I invested money in it because I was like, that's just continuing what we watched. I was like, all right, now you're doing it. Sweet. I want to help you do that. Cause it's,
that's awesome, man.
You know, that's sort of the way it should be, right? You want to promote it. Then who knows, some other grommet sitting at home watching it on his lounge in Newcastle in like 2008, just watching a random DVD that his mate's got. It just keeps that going, I guess.
I feel like I watch them sometimes and I get a kick out of them, but I feel like if other people, because they're so amateur, like
you can't like I said earlier, man, people listen to this. It's just me talking to people and people listen like in England and Korea and, you know, other places. I don't get it. You just put shit out there and see what happens, I guess.
I don't know. It's a bit cringeworthy at times.
I get that.
I get that. Self-consciously. But
yeah. Yeah,
so it's fun. Yeah.
Let's sidestep to something less fun about when you just messed up your knee or your leg.
Yeah, so that was the same sort of era. That's when the booze crew was was in full effect.
Yeah.
And again, it was just, and this was when we were in the third bar that I'd been involved in, but this, yeah, the third one I kind of owned outright with a partner, with Dale.
Right.
This was the Chico's bar.
Chico's, right.
Yeah. So the first bar that I did those early years, that lasted for me about 18, not even 2 years. And I was just suddenly so burnt out on it.
Well, yeah, bar work does that. I mean, I worked in a bar for 8 months and I was like, this is not sustainable.
Yeah. Nah, it was just too good a time. But man, it drove me like really I was really tired and just didn't want to drink, didn't want to party for ages.
Right, yeah. Sleep when you're dead. Remember we used to say sleep when you're dead. Oh, yeah. You keep doing that for a while and then you just die.
And actually after that, I ended up leaving. I left for about 9 or 10 months and I went sort of backpacking around Asia by myself.
Right, yeah.
And that, there's another story there, but I won't go into it.
Okay.
I ended up back in Hokkaido with the lady who ended up marrying.
Yeah, Yumi-san.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Going back to what you were saying, and then a few things happened over the years, and then we ended up just keeping doing the bar thing and snowboarding hard. And then it was early, I got married in the end of 2006.
Yeah.
To Yumi in November 2006. And then, so right at the start of a winter and just kept on keeping on. And I don't know, it got to that winter, early 2007. And I basically just was snowboarding. I jumped and did like a 360, but straight into a tree.
Right.
And I wrecked my left self pretty bad. I snapped my femur.
Oh.
My right femur. So that was pretty messed up. I completely snapped it in half.
Jesus.
Yeah, that was bad. And then ended up in hospital and stayed there for about a month.
So do you remember when it happened? Do you remember what were your thoughts at the time?
Yeah, I do. I totally remember. So I sort of came off this jump and I came off sort of, I remember coming, there was a jump that we sort of would hit every single day because you just sort of ride past it. It was on the side of one of the main runs.
Yep.
And I remember coming off it. And I remember looking down at my toes. I think I was trying to do like a spin, a 360 or something. And I remember looking at my toes coming off the jump and I noticed I was at an angle. Like I'd come off it. I'd sort of carved too hard off the jump. And I remember immediately thinking, because I knew there was a tree there on the side. And I remember just, it almost went slow motion in my head. And it was like, okay, you kind of it was something along the lines of get ready.
Right.
There's going to be a tree coming up or something, something like that.
Yeah.
And I think I did the whole spin. And then sure enough, the tree's like right there. And it's just like, boom. And it was really hard. And then sort of fell down in a pile, but I kind of landed. So my snowboard, which your feet are sort of connected to, my board was like dug into the snow, I think on the nose or the tail.
Yeah.
So it's sort of sticking up out of the snow and the tree's on my right. And my head's sort of downhill, like my feet are uphill and I'm sort of upside down on the mountain. And I remember the pain and my leg was literally wrapped, my thigh was wrapped around this tree.
Jesus.
And I remember running my hand down my pants, the outside of my snowboard pants. And then I felt it just go around a 90 degree.
Jeez.
Halfway down my thigh. And I remember my first thought was shit, I've ripped my leg off, is what I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was screaming and stuff because it was, yeah, but I remember just thinking, I've ripped my leg off.
Fucking
that was my first, memory was
that is brutal. Like
that. Yeah, it was real bad.
So we'll stay with this for a little bit and then we'll move to happier thoughts in a sec, I promise. But
just let me have a drink.
Yeah, have a swig. I'll give you a moment. Jesus. So for someone who's choose your own adventure and get moving, how was that for you? Because the rehab obviously must have taken, how long was the rehab?
I went for months, but they kept me in hospital for four or maybe even a bit over a month, like 4 or 5 weeks. I think I was in hospital.
Now, I remember when this happened, and I remember thinking, how, more than anything else, how is JC coping with sitting still?
Oh, but I was just messed up.
Right.
I don't know. I just remember firstly, it's just like the first few days of just the pain.
Yeah.
They couldn't operate. I remember that. I think because of the swelling, they had to have me in traction for Jesus. Like 3 or 4 days before they could operate. And that's basically where, you know, like in the cartoons where they have like a weight and a rope attached to your leg. Yeah,
rope attached to your legs and your arms. And
with like weights hanging off the end of it. And so the bone's still completely broken, but it's just, it's pulling you apart. It's pulling the bone apart. So your muscle contractions don't pull it closer together.
Jesus.
And I remember the nurses kept hitting their head on the weight or something, on the pulley. And it would vibrate my whole leg. And like, it was like, you've got a broken, completely broken femur inside your leg, just rubbing against whatever it's rubbing against. It was just horrendous.
So in that time, I'm guessing that's a pretty big test for Yumi, right? That's a big thing to do,
yeah.
Newly married. And like, what did she have to do for you? Like, what, she's your, sure. She was your only family there, right?
Yeah. I mean, her family's up there too. So they were good, but yeah, she was just a star, you know, and she was working as well. And so she would come in when she could, in before work or after work and on her days off and stuff. And I don't know, she was just, I mean, there's not much she could really do except come and hang out with me once in a while. And
yeah, right.
I mean, it was really, and I had quite a few friends up there, so there's always people coming by. It was pretty boring, but I just, I don't know, read books and,
yeah,
hung out for a while, but man, definitely slowed me down.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you describe her as a star. Like, I've known her. I met her for 2 days,
yeah.
Right, in 2005. Yeah. She's a star. She just was just a person where you're like, oh, sweet, right, this makes sense. She's awesome. That's just going to work.
I mean, she's put up with all sorts of my garbage over the years. And, the broken leg's probably not even the biggest thing. So she's solid gold.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
You could tell you are a lucky man, even with a busted femur.
But that's sort of part of it too. Like, that's part of the whole 20 years over here. It's like, I think just when, you know, the proverb, like, just met the girl, right?
So yeah,
you know, met her early on. Met her in 2002.
Right.
Talking about it earlier, yeah. At dinner tonight, actually, we said we've almost been together for 20 years.
2002, you met her? It's weird how much our lives are, like, paralleled in that way. Both got married 2006.
Yeah.
Sort of. I'd met Justine maybe 2001, but I didn't really know her until 2002.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, man. Makes you think, wow. Man.
Totally, dude.
Now, are we going to crack on? I want to, let's go from like, from that breaking your leg. Like, when did you get into triathlons?
Well, that was kind of part of it. The leg, I was always, I don't know if you remember, I mean, but even, I mean, you would remember when we were living in together, but I was always really, really into triathlon, like, just from the couch, basically.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, and this goes back to high school.
I remember you being quite the good long distance runner, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was okay.
Yeah, I mean, for as far as like when you're at school and you're like, oh, the best people in our year, wow, they're awesome at long distance running, but that's kind of what it was like, right?
It was such a big thing.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I guess back at like high school, cross country was kind of cool, but I remember, I distinctly remember actually when I really got an interest in triathlon was when, and it was the Hawaii Ironman in 1994 when Greg Welsh, the Australian, won.
Yeah,
and I think it was on the back page of the newspaper, and for some reason it, I just got really stoked on seeing that, and I got really interested in watching it. And it used to be on the Wide World of Sports every year. They do that.
That's right. It was always a big thing where they, I remember very clearly, they would like show it. The Wide World of Sports used to be like 3 hours long. And then, you know, every 20 minutes, they'd go back and show you a bit more of the Hawaiian Ironman and then go away from it and show you something else and then come back to it. So you get the whole story as it went along.
And I was just really, I just used to love watching it. And then there was all these other, triathlon was really, I guess, starting to take off in Australia. They remember there were all those televised series on,
like the mid 90s were big for triathlon and the Ironman, like the surf life saving kind of Ironman.
Yeah, Uncle Toby's.
Yeah, like who the hell's Trevor Hendy? Everyone knew Trevor Hendy in like the mid 90s.
Oh, household name.
Household name. Yeah. Just
but like triathlon, I mean, Greg Welsh, Brad Bevan.
Yeah.
You know, all those guys. I was really into that stuff, just following it, like watching it when it was on TV and you know, reading magazines and stuff. And it was also like, used to hang out with a couple of guys, well, with a guy at school, Chris, remember Dance Music?
Yeah, Dance Music.
Chris Demetriou. Yes,
Chris Demetriou, Dance Music. Jesus.
A really good mate.
Yeah.
He actually went on to race triathlon professionally.
Yeah, I remember that. Totally. In
the, I guess the early 2000s. Or yeah. Mid, something like that.
Did he, I don't know if he won, but the one they do in Cairns. I'm sure didn't he do really well in one of the blanking now, but I'm sure there was one in there that he did quite well in.
I was following him. I remember when he was racing Ironman Australia for one year, and because he's a really good runner, and they called him like the White Kenyan or something.
Right.
Yeah. But I haven't spoken to Chris in years either. But once in a while, he'll pop up. You know, he'll post a message like if I. Right. Usually, like if I've been in Hawaii to race there, he's been like, "Wow, like, can't believe like you're over there."
Yeah,
you know, think back to like the 90s.
Yeah, so you, part of your recovery was, I guess, what, running was the big part, or just the cycling, or everything.
I got to a point. I don't know what. There's something clicked, and I just again, I'd been this like armchair fan of triathlon for many years, even, and then going through the whole snowboard. You know, like, I mean, I was smoking cigarettes, drinking all the time.
Yeah. But
always following, like, if it came on, like, if there was an opportunity to catch it on, you know, we used to be able to download the torrents of the Hawaii Ironman and watch the full coverage of the race. Or, or if I went traveling, I'd always find myself buying, like, a triathlon magazine for the aeroplane. And so I always followed it, but I just never did it. And then I broke my leg, and I remember, and that was it. I was like, look, I'm going to actually, stop, I don't know, dreaming about it, I guess.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm going to buy a bike. And that was what I did. I bought a bike, and that was sort of part of the rehab, I guess. And I still couldn't run for ages because I had quite a few issues with the leg. But it's kind of made it. I mean, if you ever, like for me, like a life changing, something that really changes the direction of your life, it was definitely breaking the leg.
Right.
Because that was. Yeah, after that, I suddenly somehow just made some decision that I wanted to actually do triathlon rather than just watch it.
So, I mean, going back to our couch in Denison Street in Newcastle, late 90s, one of the all-time things to watch at the end of a long night was the 95 Ironman World Championships.
Yeah, dude, that was great.
For some reason, you had like a two-hour video of that one. Did you have any others? That was just always the one we watched.
That was the only one. That was like the recorded it from Wide World of Sports.
Right. So we had a 2 hour breakdown of the Ironman World Championships, watching Mark Allen chase down Thomas Heyriegel. Is that how you pronounce his name? I've got it in front of me, JC. I'm not remembering this off the top of my head. But I knew it was 95 and I knew Mark Allen won with the grip.
Good research.
Oh man, like we watched that so many times. So when you started like getting, you know, back into it and making a go of it, was that your ultimate goal? Before I even get into that, the Ironman World Championships in Kona in Hawaii is what, just go through the actual details of the race. It's a 5K swim.
It's 3.8 K
3.8.
swim.
It's not that
Yeah.
long. Sorry, it's not, it's a short swim. 3.8 K swim, 180 K
180 K
bike ride,
bike.
and a marathon.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, but it's in, I mean, that's sort of the standard distance for any.
Yeah, any triathlon. So that's
any
the standard
Ironman triathlon.
But
the thing is,
yeah,
being in Hawaii, it's the world championship. So it's I guess it's the, I don't know, in triathlon, it's like the Wimbledon or the Super Bowl or whatever, you know, it's the big deal. It's the main. The
and you cycle, and run across hot, lava flats.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. There's, I mean, all these, basically the whole bike ride is just out on the highway that goes up to the northern part of the island, and it's all, it's really desolate, but it's all these old black, you know, lava fields. It's just all black lava with
just
this highway.
Absorbing the heat.
It's pretty hot, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's humid and it's windy. Like the wind can be really brutal.
Right. I didn't realize that.
That wind, like you don't really get anywhere else. It's pretty crazy at times.
So,
it can blow you up.
So you, like I said, when you started training, getting your strength back in your leg and started thinking about doing triathlons, was this ever part of your thought process?
It was always part of like the inspiration and like, I guess almost visualizing it. Like I even today I train and I, you know, like that race we used to watch together in Denison Street.
Yeah.
The 95 Ironman. Like I can pull quotes out of that in my head.
Oh, me too.
Like get to this place in training where it gets you going, I guess. And it gets you inspired and I don't know, you know, it's, so it was always really like, it was such an inspiration for me just watching those races and it would get me really going. But I honestly never thought, like I knew I wanted to try one day.
Yeah.
Man, but I there's no way. Like how, I mean, Hawaii is for the best of the best. Like how can you even, you know, how can you even contemplate that would ever even be possible for you sort of thing?
So was there a tipping point though? Was there a tipping point where you thought, yeah, okay, I'm gonna make a push at this?
There wasn't. There was the only push was that I wanted to do one, and I knew again I would go through. I trained really hard for it, and I trained with inspiration and music and in my head and quotes in my head and
John McLean,
heroes,
John McLean, the heart of a lion.
Yeah, that's like images of heroes that I've had and stuff, right. And that stuff gets me going. I love that stuff. But no, I mean, it was too far.
Yeah,
too far to reach for. I was like, there's no way. Like, I wouldn't even didn't even contemplate it.
So I'll just distract you by saying I met John McLean. He did a tour of like rural schools after the 2000 Olympics. I think he won gold at the 2000 Olympics. This is a wheelchair athlete who competed the Ironman World Championships in 1995, was featured on that video we watched so many times. And I actually met him and I just couldn't get it out of my head. John McLean, the heart of a lion. I was just like, oh my God. And I got to meet him, shake his hand and be like, hey, I watched, everyone was talking about the Olympics and I was like, hey, I watched your like Ironman from Kona in 95. And he was just like, yeah, brutal. Just brutal.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
So I met him, right? So what did you do?
Well, I haven't met John McLean. I've seen him. I see you that. I think I sent you a video once from the Kona.
Yeah.
The welcome party. I was there.
Yeah.
By myself. The first year I went to Hawaii by myself.
Right.
And I was at this huge, the big, huge party they have, like the big ceremony thing. And he got up on stage and he walked on stage.
Yes, right.
And I think I might have sent you a video of that.
Yeah.
I was just like, holy shit, like this guy, like this is Matty B. Like we used to watch this guy. He's walking.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah
Jesus. The inspiration, right? Just holy shit. Just pushing yourself to the limit. So you're training and you're competing in events. But at what point, like there must have been a point because you have to qualify, right, for Kona.
Yeah.
So was there an event that you were racing where you were aiming to qualify?
Again, it wasn't for me. I can honestly say, like, it wasn't a goal. I mean, it was more a dream than anything.
Yeah.
Of course, I always wanted to, you know, wow, like to race in Hawaii. But I just never thought it was possible.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just didn't have enough experience in the sport, and I guess with that, you don't have confidence either.
Yeah.
But I did a race, the first Iron, it wasn't an Iron Man sort of branded race, but I did the same distance. So an Iron distance race.
Yeah.
I did one in 2012 down in an island off southern Japan.
Yeah.
And that's what I trained for. That was like my first sort of crack at that sort of, you know, that distance, that 3.8K swim, 180 bike and 42 marathon.
Yeah.
And I trained really hard for that, and I did it. And I won my age group in it.
Wow. So
completely surprised. Like, I don't know, I won the age group, and I think I came like eighth or ninth overall in the entire race, including the professional guys and everything.
Shit. And did you know that was, it's a weird question, but did you know that was happening at the time?
No idea.
Right. You're just running your own, doing your own race, right?
I might have known. I don't know. I might have known coming off the bike when people sort of can say, oh, you're in whatever place, you know.
Yeah.
But again, then you got to run a marathon.
Shit. So I just point out to people who are unfamiliar, I'm just got the results of the 95 Ironman. Mark Allen won the Hawaii Ironman in 8 hours, 20 minutes, 34 seconds. So that's a lot of exercise in one day for him. So you do this event, you surprise yourself, obviously. Does that qualify you for Kona? And then
no, that didn't. That qualify, I don't know. I did that and they said, oh, you've qualified to represent. I ended up representing Japan.
Right.
At the world, not the Ironman, but they had these, it's called the World Long Distance Championship.
Yeah.
And that was cool. They said, oh, you can represent the Japanese team and go to the World Championship. It was in Spain. And it was like 2 months later or something. And I was like, yeah, going to Spain. So I was stoked.
Right. Sweet.
But it was the next year, 2013. And then they got all these, for some reason, because Ironman Japan, it used to be one of the biggest sort of Ironman races in the world, sort of back in the, like, I guess, late 80s, early 90s. It was a huge event. It was one of the top three. It was one of the first three or four Ironman races in the world, actually.
Right.
So it was a big race. And then it was every year. And then it actually disappeared for a few years. It just sort of dropped off the scene. I don't know if it was a financial thing or what, but it disappeared. And then at the start of 2013, out of nowhere, they announced that Ironman Japan was coming back. And they're actually going to do it in late, right here where I live, basically. We've got a really beautiful lake. It's called Lake Toya. I don't know if you went there.
I don't know if I did.
It's literally, it's only about 30 kilometers from where I am now, where I live.
Yeah.
I was like, what? Like Ironman Japan's coming to like, basically like a hometown race.
Right.
But it's Ironman Japan.
Choose your own adventure, man. Choose your own adventure.
Yeah. And I mean, and then we were just like, I was just like, for sure, going to do that. And that was sort of the next goal, I guess, was like, let's do another Ironman. And it's, but it's a real Ironman this time.
Yeah.
And it's home. Like, you can sleep in your own bed and drive there. It's, you know, and so train up for that that was in August 2013. And we did that. It was amazing. And that was a crazy time of year because Yumi was pregnant with we've got twins, as you know, and Yumi was pregnant with our twin girls. Who were born about 3 or 4 days after the race. It was a crazy period.
All right.
And I did quite well in that race. Again, not really having any expectation, just training really hard and that race I guess I won my age group again and that one qualified me for Hawaii for the first time.
Wow. So yeah. When you qualified, were you super excited or terrified or just stunned?
Oh, stunned for sure. Like, couldn't believe it. The crazy thing is too, like a really good mate of mine, he's my neighbor. He lives directly next door to me.
Yeah.
Like I'm looking out my window now, I can see his house like 50 meters away. And he moved over here in about, I think in 2013 as well, at the start of that year. And he was a really big cyclist and had done a few triathlons and stuff. And so he actually trained for the Ironman as well. And we sort of both did it together.
Yeah.
And he's an Aussie guy as well. And he's a legend, he's named Ryan. And we were both in the same age group. And in this race in 2013, I came first and he came second. So we got like this 1-2 finish.
Wow.
Big race. And we lived next door to each other and we both qualified for Hawaii. It was crazy. We couldn't believe it. We were just like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah, Jesus.
Like, you're racing against all these people who come from other countries and it's quite an international field. And yeah, but I think that one we definitely had probably like a real, I guess, just local advantage, because it's pretty, I mean, we train on all the roads where the course was, where the bike course went.
Right, yeah. So
it's very hilly, and so it was tough. It's a really hard course, and I think we just had that advantage knowing the course and knowing the hills and things. And we.
So this is 2014. Is that the first 15. Year you went to Kona?
Yeah, so that Japan race was 2013 and it qualified you right. for Hawaii 2014.
Right, gotcha. Yeah. So the lead up to, I mean, we could spend a lot of time on how you train. Look, I don't, and what I've never understood is how you do anything for 10 hours. Like how you just go, right, I'm just going to swim, cycle, run for 10 hours. Well, is once you start doing that, is a lot of it then mental?
I think probably most of it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably, I'm convinced that's probably been my start talking about bad results. Like
yeah.
I've struggled mentally a lot of the time.
Yeah.
With a lot of the races, just not, once you get into a really sort of negative mindset when things aren't going well and you feel horrible and you always feel horrible. You yeah. can't go through a 10-hour day like that.
Feeling great.
It's not just peachy and roses all day. Like
yeah.
you go through some really low points. And so I've learned over the years that I've struggled a lot to come out of those dark spots.
Right.
And because you always do come out of them, usually.
Yeah.
And you surprise yourself when you come out of them. You're like, wow, like I was ready to die 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And now I'm actually okay. I can run again. Like but when you're in that dark hole, it's just like, it's the end of the world. It's like, I can't do this. Like, what am I doing? I hate this. Like, this is the worst. Like every negative thought, you know, and it just compounds and gets worse and worse. It's,
yeah.
it's pretty horrible. But when you overcome all that and you get to the end, or it feels pretty good. It's just, that's the challenge, I think. It's, you know, you've got to be in pretty decent shape to get through, like physically,
yeah.
the long day of exercise. But you definitely go through some real like mental battles during the course of the day. And I think it feels better when you get, because that's when it's easiest, when you feel horrible, you're like, you know what, the easy option is just to give up.
Yeah,
the easy option
right.
to stop, the option is to slow down.
And yeah, and you stop difficult. And you might, you know, you've had a few, I mean, we're talking about the World Championships in Hawaii, like the toughest race there is. Have you had any where you didn't finish?
Yeah, quite a few.
Yeah.
You know, and they're so regretful.
Yeah, because you finish because you think it's over. How long after finishing do you regret that decision?
Like immediately.
Yeah,
immediately.
Right.
Yeah. It's the worst. And it's that's what I mean. It's the easiest decision. It's so easy just to say, I'm out.
Yeah.
It's the easiest thing to do. And then as soon as you say that, you're like, oh shit, what have I done? You know? And then
yeah.
because those races, you see people coming in at midnight and coming to the finish.
Like, yeah.
You're like, surely I could have just walked.
Yeah.
Just got to the end, you know? But at that particular time though, it's hard, man. It's like, you tell yourself, I just.
But I remember you, so you finished the 2014, right? That's the first one you did and you finished it?
Yeah.
In just over 10 hours?
Just over 10 hours. I can't remember.
Jesus, you're crazy, man. But I remember you saying like very soon afterwards, like, oh yeah, it was okay. I would have liked to go under 10 hours. And you're like, what kind of sport are you doing where you do all of that? And you're like, yeah, got to do it again. Gonna see if I can shave that 15 minutes off or 5 minutes off, whatever it is, to get under that goal.
It's just, I think once you, I mean, when you're training, you train for months for these things, and you kind of, I think you have an understanding of what you might be capable of physically. And so if you put the simple mathematics to it, and you're like, I can swim, if I swim, this time, training, it tells me that I should be able to swim an hour, for example, or 58 minutes or whatever. And training, I'm pretty sure I can ride 180K in like under 5 hours. And based on my training, I think I can run a marathon in like, this is after 180K bike, but I think I can run a marathon in like 3 hours, whatever. And you put those maths together and you're like, that equals 9 hours 30 or whatever,
I just plus
But
plus plus done.
it's a piece of cake. But
Let's go. Let's go. It's easy.
but it's what you don't, it's the elements, it's the weather, it's the heat, it's the mental side, it's the nutrition. Like that's a huge part of the puzzle. Just it's hydration, dehydration. So there's all these other aspects, and of course the mental side and the, I guess.
I was going to ask you, which was like, we watched that video, right? Which is just super impressive. Mark Allen in the running leg, just wearing down his opponent, just being relentless. The guys run again, he does it all in 8 hours 22 or something, and loses by 2 minutes. He's just in front all day and then just gets run down. And you watch that, and that's inspirational. But that's also from memory, the event that had like Paula Newby-Fraser, right?
That's right.
Where
She
she's
collapsed.
leading the women's race with like 1 kilometer to go. And she just melts down.
That's right. I remember
And
that.
she can't even walk. So like when you were doing it and we were following it, the benefit of the internet was that you could just follow along and keep track and how you're going and basically just saying you're still going. That's awesome. That's awesome. But I just thought, like, as soon as I just thought about myself and I thought about any kind of negative, I'm thinking running, thinking Mark Allen, Mark Allen, Mark Allen. But there must be just a quick trigger to that negative side of it, of like, you've seen what this race can do to people. That's the mental side of it, right?
Well, that's like you watch those movies and that coverage with the nice music and the air conditioning in your house and stuff, and it looks delightful, and it's really, but it's totally right. Like you're out there and it's all that's gone, right? And it's just you and I don't know 2,000 other people or whoever, whatever, and you got to like cover a long way. It's a long distance to cover.
Jesus, yeah.
So I don't know, but it's so doable, it's so achievable. Like you see all sorts of people do it, and that's the thing that I think's maybe a bit misunderstood, is people think it's like this just this elite level athletic achievement. But I mean, maybe Hawaii, because it's the world championship and it's really hard to qualify. But I think qualifying for Hawaii is probably harder than the Hawaii race itself. It's so competitive these days with fast age group amateur athletes. But you go to any other Ironman, there's, I don't know, 50 or 100 of them around the world these days. They're you see the people doing these things, like, I mean, male, female, young, old, 60, 70 years old, overweight. I mean, it's just a personal challenge. Like you've got, I think they have like a 17-hour time cut off time limit to get these things done. And I mean, these people, they come in at like 16, 17 hours, and they've been, I think those people are more amazing actually, because I know for me, for my personality, if I looked at my watch and I saw and it said that I've been exercising for 14, 15 hours, I'd be like, bugger this, I'm done, I'm going home. I don't have the mental fortitude to keep. But so I guess to go faster, if you're doing 9, 10 hours, or whatever. I guess maybe you could argue it. I mean, it's painful for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's painful for everyone. Least, that's a great way to look at done, it.
At least you're usually done before the sun's gone down.
Yeah.
And it's just a long day. And I always look at these Ironman races like you sleep in your bed the night before, you wake up really early on this one day. You know, you might wake up at 2 or 3, get through at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever. You have your breakfast, you go, you get you ready, you do this race, but by the time it's just one day of your life.
Yeah,
it's
right.
One day. And you get there, you get to the finish after a really long, bloody hard day.
Yeah.
You recover a little bit and then you go back to your hotel or your home or whatever, and you're sleeping in your bed again. And you, when you go to bed that night, you're like, I'm back in bed. Remember when I got out of bed this morning? Like, look what I've done. It's only one day. And I look at it that way a lot. It's like, there's a lot more races, crazy stuff out there where people just don't sleep and they go for days on end.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the 100, 200 kilometer races and the through bushland and all that stuff. It's the ultra marathons. Unbelievable. Yeah. What people push themselves to do.
Sleep deprivation or I don't know. I don't go for that sort of stuff.
No.
So it's one day. If you look at it that way, you're like, wow.
It's half. It's less than half a day, man.
You're just living life for one day, just going hard for a day. And when you lie down that night, you're like, wow, like what a day. That was a big day.
That was a big day. All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up. It's been awesome talking to you about it. So I could literally keep picking your brain about the Ironman, and I'd be happy if there was a 2-hour video of you running and doing the Hawaiian Ironman that I could commentate over the top of. It'd be frigging awesome, and ask you all about it. Do a DVD commentary. But I've just earlier messaged Wiggins. Those of you listening to the podcast, you know who Wiggins is. He's been on this one like 9 times. He has a few questions for you.
Wigo.
Yeah, Wigo. Wigo's got a couple of questions for you here. Now,
okay.
As always, he's gone obscure things that only we'll understand, first off, which is, why did you do Kona and not put your sunglasses Bodine style? That's what we want to know. That's really all we've got you here for, is why didn't you do your entire run leg, cycle leg of the Kona Ironman with your glasses on upside down? That's all we want to know. I'm cutting everything out of this interview. This is all that we're here for.
Okay, that's perfect.
So why, man?
I've contemplated that for years.
We need to design a pair that look like they're upside down, but they're actually fit perfectly.
I remember you guys sending me, I think I got photos from you.
Yeah, every year, man. Every year you do it. Bodine photos.
Photos from the Dresden family.
Yeah.
And all the Bodine upside down. No one's going to know what you're talking about.
No. Who knows? I don't know. You know what? Do you understand it? Because I don't. Well, tell me where it comes from.
Jeff Bodine.
Yeah. And why?
There was a game we played.
Yep.
And he was a NASCAR?
NASCAR, driver? Yeah. He's a NASCAR driver. Yeah.
And his picture on the, this is like what, PlayStation 1?
Yeah, PlayStation 1. Yeah, definitely.
And he had his glasses on upside
down.
He
had his glasses on upside down.
And he was a legend. And was he always winning? I think
he always won. He was always, seemed like he was a little bit dirty. And he always won. And his picture had his glasses on upside down.
Why wouldn't you strive to be like
that? No, that's true. All right. More importantly, Wiggins is kind of impressed with your world championship triathlon results. But is your half-court shot to win the basketball game against Orange in year 12 your greatest sporting achievement?
Yes. 100% yes.
100% yes.
I can still, if I close my eyes, I can still relive that.
Right.
I could see Wigo down the other end of the court.
Yeah.
Chucking the ball. I can see the whole sequence.
Yeah, like a movie, that one, wasn't it? Right on the buzzer.
I can totally see it.
Winning the game.
I screamed out to him and he's like, he launched it up to me and I think it was a turnaround jumper as well. Like I might have taken one bounce, I can't remember. And she was like, 1, 2, and it went in and
on the buzzer.
And I remember scratching him. I remember he ran over and like we hugged each other, and I think I caught him in the eye with a fingernail or something, and I think I scratched him pretty good on the eye.
It's worth it. All worth it.
Yes. That takes the cake. Best ever.
Yeah. Fantastic. All right. Thanks so much, JC. It's been amazing.
Man, that was awesome. Thank you so much for the call, Maddie.